Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Aleph by the two dots. Say, Mara is quoting from the Mishnah, Matzah, Chamura, Parav, Chulei, that the Mishnah gives us definitions of what is considered to be a Parua or Chamur that are not lost. And then it gives a definition of what is considered to be a Chamur and Para that is lost. The problem is that those are extreme cases, but it leaves out the cases that are in the middle. And that's what the Gemara is noting over here. Hagufa Kasha. There is an internal contradiction within the Mishnah, which is Amart, Matzah Chamor Upara Roim Baderech. If you find a Chamor and a Para that are grazing gracefully on the way, Ein Zo Aveda. Roim Baderech Hu Dolo Avu Aveda. That's only because they are grazing on the normal path, on the normal roads. Ha Ratzah Baderech. If it was running along the roads, Viro'eh Ben Akramim, or it was grazing amongst the vineyards, Havia Aveda, then it would be an Aveda. That would be the diuk out of the ratio. Hey, Masefa, if you look at the next line in the Mishnah, which says, Chamor v'kelav hafuchim upara ratzah ben akramim, if you find a chamor whose load or saddle have been overturned, or you have a para which is running through the vineyards, harizo Aveda, that's considered to be a lost item. Ratzah ben akramim hu davi Aveda, that's only if it's running amongst the vineyards, that is considered to be an Aveda. Haratzah bederech viro'eh ben akramim, if it's running on a normal road, or it's grazing in the vineyards, ein zo aveda, that's not considered to be an aveda. So you have a stira in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah only addresses the case, whereas Rashi notes you have either tarte l'tivuta, you have two items that make it positive, or tarte l'riuta, or two things that make it negative. The two that are positive is that it's both on the derech, and it is grazing gracefully. The Tarte L'riuta is that it is running and it's found in the Kramim. The problem is that the cases in between that where you have one, the Tivuta, and one, the Riuta, which means that it's either running on the road or grazing in the vineyard, those aren't addressed by the Mishnah. And from each half of the Mishnah, you'd be Midayek, the opposite conclusion. So that's what the Gemara says here. We have an internal contradiction in the Mishnah. So Amar Abaye, answers, Yagid alav re'o, that his friend will tell us about him, or testify about him, which is that one piece of information will guide us as to the other piece of information, which is Tana. Ro'eh b'derech, dolav yaveda, vo'adin l'ro'eh ben akramim. In the first half of the Mishnah, it says when it's grazing on the road, that's not considered an aveda. It is a similar din with regards to grazing ben akramim amongst the vineyards. So grazing is what the Mishnah is telling us about, and it's irrespective of where it is. Tana Ratza ben Akramim. The Tana noted that if it was running amongst the vineyards, Davya Veda, that would be considered an Aveda. Vuadin the Ratza Baderech, and the same would be true if it was running along the road. So Abaye basically says that the Mishnah is distinguishing between grazing gracefully and running. And it's irrespective of the location. So Amalei Rava, Rava says that doesn't make so much sense. Igagida lavre'o, litne kilta, v'koshekein chamirta. If you are right about one giving us information about the other, then you should have written the case that is the kal case, and then we would have drawn a conclusion to the chamur case, which means litne ratzah baderech, then tell us about running on the road, to have aveda. If you tell us there that that's an aveda, but koshkein ratzah ben akramim, then certainly if it's running amongst the vineyards, it would be an aveda. Why give the example of running in the vineyards? You would not automatically extrapolate from running in the vineyards to running on the road. Running in the vineyards has tarte l'riuta, it's in the vineyards, and he's running. Running on the road only has one l'riuta. So if he was running on the roads and you told us it was an aveda, then you're right, I could extrapolate to kramim. But the other way around, that's not the case. And similarly, by Ru'eh, Vilitne Ru'eh ben Akramim. If you told me that if he was grazing gracefully in the vineyard, that was Dolavi Aveda, that would not be considered an Aveda, but Koshkein Ru'eh Baderech. Then certainly, if he was grazing on the road, I would have known that. But now that you gave him the information, the opposite, what you said is grazing on the road, from there I can't necessarily extrapolate to grazing in the Kramim. So Rava rejects Abaye's explanation of the Mishnah, or reconciliation of the Mishnah. Elam Rava. Rava offers an alternative. Ratzah, ratzah, lo kasha. Running and running is not a question. Ha, the apa, the gabe, dabra. Ha, the apa, the gabe, mato. Depends which way the animal is running. The animal is running into the fields. Then there's a problem because it's running in the opposite direction of where it should be going. If it's running towards the city, then it's not an Aveda because it's running towards the place where it'll be found or that it's coming home. So that's not an issue. Ru'eh aru'eh nami lo kasha. Grazing on grazing is also not a problem. Kan ba'vedat gufa. Kan ba'vedat karka. Depends what we're worried about here. Are we worried about the animal itself? That's Aveda gufa. Or are we worried about the losses to the vineyard? Because both of those are losses, and we might have to worry about them. Kik tani ru'eh b'derech. When it says that you're grazing on the way, lo havi aveda, that's not considered to be an aveda. Ha ru'eh ben akramim, havi aveda, implying that if it was grazing in the vineyards, it would be an aveda. That's b'avedat karka. We're not worried about the animal. The animal's grazing gracefully. What we're worried about is the damage it does to the vineyard itself, to the vines and to the vineyard. V'chik tani ratza ben akramim, when it says that it's running in the kramim, havi aveda, haro'eh ben akramim, lo havi aveda, but then if it was grazing in the kramim, it would not be an aveda, that's ve'avedat gufa, that's speaking about the animal itself. So when it comes to avedat karka, then we have a problem when it's grazing in the vineyard. When it is grazing in the vineyard, we have no problem in terms of avedat gufa, the loss of the animal, the damage that is done to the animal. So now the Gemara says, Deratza ben akramim maskva, because when the animal runs in the vineyard, you can see here the word maskva, which you can see Mesorah Shas brings from the Aruch, means ose b'chabura, he gets injured. When he's running in the vineyard, he trips or cuts himself on the vines, and that causes injury to the animal itself. The word maskava, we actually saw back in the Gemara on Chav Zayin Amud Bet with regards to borrowing a saddle. We said that people don't borrow the saddle, the throw that goes on the back of the donkey on the chamor because it injures the donkey. The word there that the Gemara used was also maskava, which is to cause an injury. And yesterday Rashi on the Mishnah notes that the problem with Ratzah ben Akramim is mistakva. He adds in a tuff there, but a similar idea that it causes injury to the animal itself. V'ru'eh ben akramim, on the other hand, when it's grazing gracefully in the vineyards, lo maskava, it doesn't injure itself. Gemara says, v'ru'eh ben akramim, when it's grazing in the vineyard, nehi de lo maskava, you're right, I understand that it does not injure itself. Typically, mishum avedat karka, it still does cause damage to the land, as you yourself noted, meaning that that's the two inferences that we draw from the Mishnah. One inference from the Mishnah says that when you're grazing in the vineyard, you're chayav. In one case, it says you're not chayav to return it. So in the case where it says you're chayav to return it, we said that was the damage to the land. And the part where it says that you're not chayav to return it is with regards to the animal, because the animal's not injured in that place. But even according to the diuk that says that the animal's not injured, they still need to acknowledge that there's damage to the land. Why aren't they worried about that? It says, bidikuti. It's non-Jewish property, and therefore, there's no responsibility in terms of aveda to protect the property of the non-Jew. I mean, obviously, there's no active damage being done over here. The problem is that the animal is found there, and it's doing damage, not with the intention of the Baalim. And again, your requirement of a Shabbat Aveda only applies to a fellow Jew, Achicha, who's in the club. And so over here, you don't have to provide that service to the non-Jew and protect his property. It says, v'tipukulei mishum avedat gufa. Wait a minute. If that's the case, that we're talking about a kuti and these other Jews' animals grazing in this kuti's vineyard, maybe you should worry about the animal itself. You're telling me that the animal itself is safe, it's not being injured. The dilma katlula. Maybe the kuti will kill the animal. I mean, he'll take the law into his own hands and he'll kill the animal to protect his land. And that was considered to be not disproportionate force, but an appropriate response, at least in their eyes. And therefore, you should be in there saving the animal. Forget about the property. You should be saving the animal, because otherwise, if he kills the animal, obviously there's an Aveda problem here. Ba'atra, Dematru, Vahadra Katli. It's a nicer village or city where they first give you a citation or a warning before they kill the animal. So there is a right to kill an animal if it's doing damage to your property. That's only after a warning to the owners. And once the owners have been warned, then they will kill the animal. But Dilma Achuba, The Gemara says, how do you know whether the owner was warned or not already? How do you know this is its first offense or this is a repeat offender? It says, I'atruba, if they already warned the owner to take precaution because his animal is a repeat offender, then velo yisdaruba, and he wasn't careful about it, vadai avida midati. That's a person who is basically throwing away his animal because, in a sense, he's abandoning the animal because of the fact that he didn't take responsibility. He knows this animal has been out there doing damage or been in other people's fields before grazing. And he knows the law is that it will be killed if it's found out there on a repeat basis. The fact that he allowed it to escape again or wasn't extra careful with it already means that he's been miyayesh. He's given up hope on this animal because otherwise he would have taken the proper precautions. The fact that he didn't makes it into an aveda bedat, and then you don't have to be responsible to return it to him. In either instance, you have no responsibility. That we don't know whether the balim were warned, but if they were not warned, then the animal won't be killed. And so therefore you have no responsibility to return the aveda because the animal will not be lost in this case. They won't lose the animal. Don't have responsibility towards the karka because it's a kuti. Don't have a responsibility towards the animal who belongs to the Jew because it won't get killed. If he was already warned, then you have no responsibility towards the animal. Not because the animal won't be killed, but even if it's killed, it's not your responsibility. The balim were negligent in allowing the animal to go out again, and therefore you don't have any responsibility to return it to them because they were negligent. Right now, the Gemara comments on the latter part of the Mishnah, which says, Ekziro barcha. If you returned it, it ran away, then you have responsibility to return it multiple times. Because the Pasuk says, Hashev tishivein, that you must return it. It seems from the Mishnah that the duplication of the language is what teaches you this law. Amalei Aurumban on the Rava. So one of the Rabbonim said the Rava, Ema Hashev Chadazimna, Tishivim Trezimne. Why isn't there a cap on the number of times that you have to return the animal? Say Hashev means once, Tishivim means twice. And therefore you'd have a limit of at least two. I mean, you have a limit of a maximum of two times. But he wouldn't have this unlimited responsibility to return the animal. Amalei, so Rava says back to him, Hashev afilu kuf pe'amim. Mashma, embedded in the word Hashev is already returning it 100 times. What Rava is indicating is it's not the duplicate language that actually creates the obligation to return it multiple times, but rather the verb that is used. The way that the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot explains the terms of the conjugation of the verb, he says, Vashev, Mikor viyadua itzel kol balei lashon. It's obvious to anyone who is a grammarian. Ki amikor nofel ala ma'at velarov. That type of verb, root verb he calls it, has meaning whether you're talking about a small amount or a large amount. Tomar shamarti leploni shamur. But tomar shamarti leploni uploni shamur. So you can use the verb shamur. Zachor, all of those verbs are used whether you are going to do it for one person or you're going to do it for multiple people. Lefikach more hashev shechayav lachzir pi'amim rabot. Therefore, the word itself hashev teaches you that you have to return it multiple times. Kamo kein hakim takimimo shaleach tishalach azov ta'azov. All of these, which we're going to see in a second. So, what the Rambam says is that this type of verb like zachor, shamor, is not like the normal tzivui, which is the verb says you're instructing someone to do it, but rather zachor shamor means that you have to, on a regular basis, continue to be engaged in this activity. So if you say to someone zachor, it doesn't just mean remember once. Zachor means that you should remember whether it's once or multiple times that you should continue to remember. It's some sort of root form or infinitive form of the verb, which means to continuously be engaged in this item. Shamor, the same thing. And he says the word hashev has that same meaning. Hashev means you shall continue to return it. Not that you must return it, and that's the tzivoy, because that might be limited to one time. But hashev means that you should be engaged in the activity of returning, irrespective of the number of times. It's not giving you a directive to do it once. It's giving you a general directive, which is you must return things. So now that would mean that even if it was lost multiple times, you would still be under that injunction to return it every time or each time. So now the Gemara says, well, if Hashev already teaches you multiple times, then what is the value of the word Tishivim? The Gemara says, Tishivim, and the other Beito. You would have thought that the requirement to return the Aveda means that you must return it to his house. Leginato uluchurvato minayin. How do you know that if you return it to his garden or to this abandoned space of his, how do you know that that works? Tamalomar tishivei mikomakom. As long as you get it back into his possession. Hey chidami, what exactly is the setup here? Edemintura. If these are places that are protected, guarded, then pshita. Then it's obvious that you can return them there. How's that different than his house? If he has a garden that's walled in and fenced in, and it's a secure location, then why can't you return it to that location? Idolo mintura, if these are not secure locations, amai, why do you have permission then to return it to that place? You're not returning it to him, you're simply leaving it or abandoning it in a place that's not secure. Lolam de mintura, it's a case that it is secure. Vakamash malan, but then we said that's pshita, it's a secure location, it's no different than the house. It's teaching you, dlo binan dat balim, that you don't need the owners to be aware of the return. Uki de Rabbi Lazar, similar to the position of Lazar, damar, hakol tzrichim dat balim, everybody needs the awareness of the owner, chutz me'ashavat aveda, with the exception of returning a lost object, shatara ripta hashavot arbe, because there the Torah gave you hashav tishivim, to tell you that even if you return it without the knowledge of the owner, that is considered to be hashavat aveda. But that's not true by cases of the gazlan, ganav, dalid shomrim. Any of those individuals, if they are going to return it to the balim, they must make the balim aware of the fact that they have returned it. Otherwise, it remains in their possession and responsibility. Shavat aveda, you have a special dispensation that if you get it to a secure location that is his, you're done. You've done what your obligation is, which is to return the item to the possession of the owner. But you don't have to get it to the owner himself, simply into a secure location that belongs to him. Shaleach tishaleach. So this is with reference to shiluach hakein, which is the Torah's prescription for taking the young chicks or the eggs that you have to chase away the mother bird. Over there again, you have a double lashon. Ema shaleach chada. Zimna tishalach trei zimne. One time, two times, and that would be it. If you sent away or shoot away the mother bird twice, that would be sufficient. On the third time, you wouldn't have to shoo away the bird. So again, he says back to them, Shaleach afilu mea pi'amim. Mashma. When it says Shaleach, that is even 100 times. And again, this is similar to what the Rambam said before. This form of the verb means that you have an obligation to send it away without limit. You must send it away anytime you want to engage in this activity. So now, Tishalach en li'ela devar reshut. That's only for something that is for your own usage. The Dvar Mitzvah minayin. How do I know that even by a Dvar Mitzvah you have to do Shiluach HaKein? Tamalomar Tishalach Mikom Akom. That you have to send it away irrespective of the circumstances. So you have to think possibly that the Hava Mina here revolves around the fact that the requirement to shoo away the mother bird is because V'lakach Talach, that you want to take for yourself the eggs or the chicks. So being that it's for yourself, that would seem to indicate that if it's for your personal usage, that's when you have to engage in shiluach ha'im, you have to send away the mother bird. But if you're engaged in a mitzvah, for instance, the case, or the classic case that the midrash shalocha brings is a case of a mitzora, who needs birds in order to perform the tahara service of the mitzora. Over there, we say that you have to do shliach hakein in order to take the birds to be utilized for the mitzora. But again, there would have been a havamina, maybe since you're not taking them for yourself, but you're taking them to accomplish the mitzvah of the Torah, maybe there would be no requirement of shliach hakein. So that's why shaleach tishalach comes to teach you that irrespective of whether it's for your own usage or whether it's for the mitzvah usage, you have an obligation to shoo away the mother bird. Amrlei ho mirabon on the Rava, ve'ema hocheach chadazima, tochiach trezimne. Maybe you should say this, again another duplicate lashon, which is, lo tisnat achicha bilvavecha, hocheach tochiach et amitecha. So you have to give tochecha. So maybe the duplicate lashon again is, hocheach chadazimna, tochiach Trei zimne is twice. Amalei hocheach afilu kuf pe'amim ashma. Hocheach is similar to zachor, shamor, hashev, shaleach. All of these verbs that mean multiple times. And so to hear it means even 100 times. Tochiach, then what is the duplicate language of tochiach teach you? Enli el arav l'talmid. That's only true that the teacher has an obligation to rebuke the student. Talmid the rav minayin. How do you know that the student also has an obligation to rebuke the Rebbe? Obviously in a respectful manner and a proper manner. Tamalomar uchiach tochiach mikol makom. Chiach tochiach comes to teach you no matter what the circumstances are, no matter what the relationship is, there's an obligation on the individual to give tochacha or indicate to the person that they might be doing something wrong and they might need to rectify what they have done. Now even though, again, in the Gemara in Arachin, when it speaks about uchiach tochiach, there it says that a person has an obligation to give tochacha multiple times. Gemara in Arachin mentions that the mitzvah of being mochiach multiple kaimim comes from tochiach, not from the word ocheach, but rather from the word tochiach. So then here, why does the Gemara come to the conclusion that ocheach means afilu kuf pe'amim, even 100 times? So what some of the mefashim explain is that there would have been a thought here, chotecheach is once, tochiach is twice, is coming to teach you the difference between a single avera or multiple averot. So therefore, the Gemara in Arachin is speaking about one particular avera. There, you have to be mochiach multiple pa'amim. That comes from the tochiach. What we're speaking about over here, hocheach, the Ramban notes, is speaking about a case where you're talking about multiple averot. So the Ramban differentiates between one avera, which is learned from the word tochiach in Arachin, that you have to do it multiple times. And over here, Argamar, which learns it from hocheach, is referencing to multiple averot, and therefore there are two different limudim about the necessity to continue to give tochacha. So there are two different hochachot or tochachot that we need multiple times for. One is to teach you that even when they're not listening on the same avera, you have to repeat it. The other one is that even on different averot, that you have an obligation to continue to be mochiach, the individual. Azov, dazov imo. This we're going to get into in more detail in tomorrow's daf. But we have two small parshiot that deal with Azov Tazov Imo, and then the subsequent one, which the Gemara is going to bring in 1 second, which is Hakim Takim Imo, one of which is speaking about, according to the Gemara, Prika, unloading an animal, and the other one is speaking about Te'ina, the loading of the animal. In both those cases, you have an obligation to assist the Baalim in loading up their animal or unloading their animal. The lishonot that are used are azov tazov imo and hakim takim imo. Gemara will question again the duplication of the language. The first of which is azov tazov imo. So then again, I would have thought ein li ela balav imo. I would have thought that's only when the owners are with them. She'ein balav imo. When the owners are not there, minayin. How do you know that you have to engage in it? Tamid omar azov tazov mikol makom. That you're an obligation to do this no matter what. Now, we're going to learn in the Gemara upcoming that if the Balim sit there and say, you do it, you're under an obligation in the Torah, I'm going to watch you do this, then you have no obligation to do it. Because it says, azov tazov imo, with him, that the Balim have to do it along with the individual. They can't sit by the side and say, you take care of it. But in a situation or a circumstance where the Balim are unable to assist, whether that's because it's in Elfi Kvodam, or it's a case where they don't have the strength or capability to engage. They're too old, they're too young, or in a case where they're not available, they're not there. How do I know that there's an obligation on you to take care of the animal in that situation? Again, irrespective of the Baalim. Not when the Baalim are capable and just watching you, but in a case where the Baalim can't be engaged, how do I know you have to do it? Azov Tazov teaches you that. Hakim takim imo, ein li ela balav imo. Shein balav imo minayin. It's a similar type of structure. How do I know that there's that obligation even when the balim are not engaged with you? Tamid omar, hakim takim mikol makom. Hakim takim teaches you in any scenario. Gemara asks then, wait a minute. Lama le mikhtav prika, balama le mikhtav te'ina. Why do I have to write both the mitzvah of unloading, as well as the mitzvah of loading. That's the way Rashi reads the question of the Gemara. It's a fundamental question as to why I need two psukim, or two different laws. One about unloading, and one about loading. Had you taught me about one, I should have been able to extrapolate to the other. One of them seems to be unnecessary. The Balei Tosafot are uncomfortable with that, because they say based on the upcoming Gemara, both the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon, who argue about the meaning of the psukim, both seemingly agree that there was a necessity for the psukim, and Tosafot goes through that limud, and therefore he suggests that the Gemara's question over here is not right prika, not tina, or right tina, but not prika, but rather the question of the Gemara is, why do you need the duplicate lashon by both of them? If you're teaching me the same thing by both of them, which is that you must do it even without the balim, it would have been sufficient to either say azov tazov, and then just say hakeim, or say hakeim takim, and only say azov. Why do you need the duplicate lashon twice in order to teach you the exact same din, which is, even when the balim are not there, you are obligated to take care of it? I said, Tzricha, Dikat of Rachmana Prika, had the Torah only wrote about unloading, Havamina Mishum Tika Tsar Bale Chaim, Vika Chisaron Kis. The reason that you have to engage there, and the reason you have to help out there is because, number one, the animal is being hurt, or is in pain, over the fact that the load is not properly balanced, or needs to be taken off its back. So that's number one. Number two is, if the load remains on the animal in this manner, and it's not unloaded, it's going to actually injure the animal and cause losses to the owner. So since you have both of those, therefore I say, you have to engage, even if the balim are not there. Avaltina, loading the animal. Delav tsar bale chayim ika. There's no tsar bale chayim, because right now it's on the ground. I mean, you're not loading the animal yet, so the animal's not under duress or pain. Velo chisaron kis ika, and there's no loss to the animal because the animal's not burdened under the load. Rather, it's sitting on the side right now. There's not a possibility of injury to the animal, and there's not any loss. Ema lo. Over there, I would have said that you don't have to help out when the balim are not engaged. Viyashmeina ti'ina. Had you only taught me about ti'ina, loading of the animal, mishum de bischar. Because over there, again, this is a machloket that we're going to see upcoming in the Gemara, that over there you can charge the Baalim for your efforts. Aval prika de bichinam. Then in the unloading, which you have to do without compensation, emalo. Maybe I would say no. Tzricha. So therefore, I have it. That's the shita of the Chachamim, who believe that the difference between prika and tina is that prika must be done for free, whereas tina, you can demand compensation for the efforts or the help that you provided to the owner. So, according to Rashi, this is explaining why the Torah had to write both prika and tina, because I couldn't extrapolate one from the other. Prika, I couldn't extrapolate from, since there is tsar bale chayim and chisaron kis, which is not the case by tina. And by the case of tina, since you can get compensated, you would have thought then if you extrapolated to prika and loading, then you would also be able to be compensated, which is not true either. Therefore, I had to write each independently. That's Rashi's explanation. According to the Balei Tosafot, I have to explain to you why in each case you can work, or you should work independent of the Baalim. In one case, there's a compelling reason for you to work independent of the Baalim because of the Tsar Bale Chaim and the Chisaron Kis. In the other case, by Tina, there's also a compelling reason to work independent of the Baalim, which is that you're going to get compensated. So okay, in the case where it's free, maybe you wouldn't have to help out the Baalim when they're not available to do it. So because of that, I need the limudim by both of them, according to the Balei Tosafot, to teach you that even when the balim are absent, that you must engage. Ule Rabbi Shimon damar af tina bechinam. Again, this goes to what we're going to see in tomorrow's daf. The Rabbi Shimon believes that both prika and tina have to be done for free. Ma'ika the meimar. Then what is the chiddush in tina that you couldn't learn or extrapolate from it to the case of prika? Where it says, the Rabbi Shimon, lo misai me cry. According to Rabbi Shimon, the psukim are not well defined. We'll see this again in tomorrow's daf, that Rabbi Shimon says that it's not clear whether azov tazov imo, or akeim takeim imo, which one references prika, and which one references ti'ina. The Chachamim have a clear view on which one is prika and which one is ti'ina. And for Rabbi Shimon, had I only run in one pasuk, since the psukim are not defined over here, then prika or ti'ina, I would have assumed whichever pasuk had it referred to prika. Since I don't know which one means prika and which one's tina, I'm always going to favor interpreting the one that is speaking about prika, because prika itself is the more chamur item, as we saw before, because it involves the tzar balei chayim and it involves chisaron kis. So therefore, if I don't have a definition of which one, or if I only had one of the two psukim, or the one of the, according to Rashi, if I had one of the two psukim, or according to Tosafot, I only had the duplication of lashon in one case, I would have favored interpreting that that case is a case of prika and not of ti'ina because of the nature of prika. So in order to have both of them included in the din, I need you to tell me in both cases, either according to Rashi, I need both psukim, or according to Tosafot, I need the duplication of lashon by both cases for Rabbi Shimon. So lama le michta varnei tarte. So again, there, why do I need both psukim, according to Rashi, or according to Tosafot, why do I need the duplicate lashon in both cases? But lama le michta vaveda. And on top of that, a separate question is, why do I have to write a veda, which is also a shev tishi veim? And there also you have to work independent of the balim. Why can't I just write one of them and I can extrapolate to all the others? In all cases, you're basically helping out the balim. You're doing a shavat aveda in different senses, but you're doing the same thing. If you told me about one, I should be able to extrapolate to the others. It says, tzrichi, dika darchana hanei tarte. If the Torah had written these two, meaning prika and tina, mishum de tzara demara ita, tzara dida ita. Because in that case, you have the pain of the owner, and you have the pain of the animal itself. Meaning that the owner is distraught about what's happening or over what's happening. Plus, he has the possibility of losing money here, whether it's on the load or on the animal. And the animal is under duress or pain because of the load being improperly either loaded on or needing to be taken off. And even though before we noted that Tsar Balei Chaim is a character trait of Prika, not Ti'ina, the Rosh notes, there still is some Tsar Balei Chaim involved in Ti'ina. If someone loads the animal by themselves, it takes longer, it's not put on as well, and therefore there is Tsar involved, it's just not at the level of Tsar that is by Prika. So in terms of hierarchy, prika has the highest form of tzar, tina has a lower form of tzar, and aveda would have no tzar at all. Whereas aval aveda, by the case of aveda, the tzara demara ita, the tzara dida leita, by aveda the pain is only felt by the owner, who has lost the object and cannot find it, but the object itself is not in pain, whether that's because it's inanimate, or even if it's an animal, it doesn't mean the animal's in pain, just because it is lost, it might be very happy when it's lost. Same alo, over there, maybe you would not have an obligation. So, v'iyashmin an aveda, if you taught me about the aveda, mishum daleta lamara bahada. Over there, maybe the reason you have to engage in the aveda is because the owner is not present. Avahane tarte by these other two items, by prikantina, de'ita lamara bahada, that the owner is present, emalo tzricha. Maybe there you wouldn't have to do it, because as Rashi notes over here, Ema yakzor achar bnei adam viskor. He will hire people to take care of it. Why do you have an obligation to engage? Let him just hire Paulim, let him help workers in order to do it. So if the Balim are present, it gives you two advantages. One advantage is the fact that they're aware of the problem. The second advantage is that they can actually do something about the problem. So in that case, you would have to hire workers to do it, because the owner's aware of it, he can't do it, and he's telling you, go ahead and do it. You say, listen, if you're not doing it, I'm not responsible, we'll hire some workers to do it. Then if the owner's engaged, maybe then that's where the obligation is upon you to take care of it. So now, because of that, we can't extrapolate one to the other, and that's why we need, by aveda, a din, and by prika and tina, we need a din, meaning that we need all of this information, even though seemingly it seems extraneous or duplicative. The point is that in each case, there's a unique circumstance or unique aspect to these dinim. And those unique aspects make it that you can't extrapolate to the other din. For the Chachamim, that means that Prika has Tsar Balei Chaim Chisaron Kis. Ti'ina has the ability to charge for your efforts. And Aveda has the lack of the owner being aware or present, so that he can't take care of it. Now the Gemara continues to speak about duplicative lishonot, which is mot yumat hamakeh, that the person who kills The punishment min haTorah is that he's killed b'saif, that he's killed by the sword. Ein li ela b'mitah k'tuvah bo. Maybe there's only a requirement to kill him in the manner that the Torah prescribes. Minayim shimi'ata yechol amito b'mitah k'tuvah bo. How do I know that if you cannot accomplish putting him to death, executing him in the manner prescribed by the Torah, shata rasher amito b'chol mitah shata yechol amito, that you should kill him any way that is possible? Tamalomar mot yumat mikol makom. No matter what the scenario is, Rashi suggests over here, for instance, if he's running away, he hops on a boat and he runs away, if you can shoot him with an arrow, or you can sink the boat, you have an obligation based on this to do that in order to carry out the death penalty that is warranted for this individual, even though it's not saif, it's not the one that is prescribed min haTorah. Haked takeh, this is in reference to an ir hanidachat. Over there it says, the inhabitants of the ir hanidachat, haked takeh, that you have to wipe them out. In the elaba ka'ak tuvah bahen, seems to be that maybe you would only have to give them the death penalty that is associated with them in the Torah. Minayim shimata yechol amitam ha'ka'ak tuvah bahen, shata rasha lukutam b'chol ha'ka'ak shata yechol. How do I know, like once again here, that if you cannot accomplish the prescription min haTorah to put them to death, ayyidei saif, how do I know that you can do it any way possible? Tamalomar haket takeh mikol makom. You have to kill them in any way possible in order to eliminate the inhabitants of the ir hanidachat. So then the Gemara continues and brings another one. Hashev tashiv. So then you have to return it. Ein li ela shemashkeno b'reshut beitin. Shev tashiv is the obligation for one to return collateral that you take from a poor person, an almanah. You have to return the collateral that you took to them. So shev tashiv. Ein li ela shemashkeno b'reshut beitin. It's only in a case, or I would have only thought in a case where Beit Din entered the fray, and Beit Din is the one who took the mashkon on your behalf and then granted it to you. Mashkono shelo b'reshut Beit Din. What happens if the person of his own volition took the mashkon, meaning improperly, he went in and grabbed collateral? How do I know that Hashem Tashiv is an obligation to return it, despite the fact that it came into your possession improperly? Minayin, tamalomar, Hashev tashiv, that you have to return it mikol makom, no matter what the situation is, no matter how you came into possession of the mashkon. The truth is that it's a little difficult to understand the two stages of the Gemara over here, because if you did it b'shut Beit Din, you have to return it. Then why would you think if you did it without b'shut Beit Din that you wouldn't have to return it? That means it's chote niskar, which is that by you improperly getting access to the mashkon, now you have no responsibility to return it. Why would you ever think that? It should have been just the opposite, which is, it should be obvious by the case where you took it improperly that you have to return it. The chiddush is that even when Beit Din intervenes, you still have to give it back every day. So the Rishonim here toy with different ways to explain why you possibly might think that you don't have the obligation to return it when you take it without permission. One possibility is that this relates to the Machloket Abaye and Rava, which is when you do an action that is an Aveira, or the Torah says you may not do, is the action still efficacious? I mean, when the Torah says it's an Aveira, do they suspend your right to create whatever would happen through this action? Or do they allow it, the action to take place? You're just tagged with an Aveira when you do it. So the question here would be, when you take the collateral over here, which the Torah says you may not do, and you go ahead and you do it anyway, is your taking of collateral classified as taking of collateral or not? I mean, that might be the question here. If it's classified as taking of collateral, of course, then you'd be covered by the pasuk. If it's not classified as taking of collateral, because the Torah says when you take it, you're not successful at taking it, then maybe you don't have to return it because you didn't take collateral in the first place. It's not deemed to be collateral. Or the Meiri looks at it from the other perspective, which is maybe there's just no mitzvah to return it. Doesn't mean you don't have to return it, just there's no mitzvah. The mitzvah only applies when you took the mashkon properly. When you took the mashkon improperly, you might have an obligation to return it, but that return is not covered by the mitzvah to return the object. The Rabbeinu Yonatan actually gives an interesting explanation, which is that if a person took a mashkon without permission, then if you ask them to return it and go in and each time and take it back, you're actually going to cause strife between the parties because you already took the mashkon improperly And if he's going to give it back and try to take it again, you're just increasing the strife between the parties rather than creating goodwill, which would exist if the person was returning a mashkon taken by Beit Din, that they're returning it each day and they're doing something that's to the benefit of the party that they took the mashkon from. Over here, that benefit might be overridden by the fact that there'll be strife each time they have to engage in him taking back the mashkon, which was taken improperly. The Gemara then continues and says, Chavol Tachbol. Again, one of these psukim is found in Parshat Ki Teitzeh, which is Hashem Tashiv. The other pasuk is found in Parshat Mishpatim, which is Chavol Tachbol. Elish Mashkano Bishut. That's only if he took the mashkon with permission. If he mashkano shalom Bishut, if he took it without permission, Minayin, how do I know that's the case? Tamlomer Chavol Tachbol Mikol Makom. You have to give it back no matter what. So again, here Rashi explains that Stam Chavala Pi Beit Din Hi. That Stam Chavala means done through the auspices of Beit Din. The lo shchiach the chotzif inish likanes the bibayit, the tol metaltele shlo bershut. People are not so mechutzav to go into a person's house and take their possessions as collateral. So Rashi says it's implicit in the pasuk by the nature of the item that you're taking that it has to be done through the auspices of a Beit Din because people don't enter other people's houses in order to take collateral. The only way that can happen is if the Beit Din is involved. In the other case, before where it says ashev tashiv, over there also we know that it's done by Beit Din because the pasuk says b'chutz tamot. You have to stay outside and then the person will bring out the collateral to you. Well, the only reason the person is going to bring collateral out to you or to the shliach Beit Din is because they're compelled by the Beit Din to do it. They're not going to bring the collateral out to you just because you're standing outside. It has to be that there's some sort of impetus through Beit Din that is causing them to bring the collateral out to you. So Rashi says that's how you know in both these cases that we're talking about Beit Din. The Gemara here does ask the question, Kani Trei Krai Lomali. And you're telling me the same thing by both psukim, which is the fact that you have to return the collateral on a regular basis. I mean, even when you take it, you have to give it back. So Chadak Sut Yom, V'Chadak Sut Laila. Again, not our discussion here, but if you look in the psukim, based on the psukim, one of them is talking about the fact that you take daytime utensils or bigadim. So one is taking that you take in nighttime utensils or bigadim. And therefore, at night you must return the night clothing. And then you can re-take the collateral in the morning. And same with the daytime clothing. You have to return them during the day. You can take the collateral overnight. Or you can return him the tools during the day and take them back at night when he's not using them. So the Torah requires you to return them on a regular basis in order to facilitate the usage of these items by the individual. Remember, talking about someone who is poor, someone, an almanah, a yatom, someone who doesn't have the means by which to have multiple sets of clothing. Therefore, when you take it as collateral, you've taken the one item that they have. And again, in those days, borrowing in general was done by people who were really in financial straits, or in a difficult monetary situation by which they're sustaining themselves was at risk. And therefore, when we talk about a loan to these individuals and taking collateral from them, you're taking the item or one item that this individual has to perform this service or to wear. And therefore, Torah says you must return it to them. Patoach tiftach. So there it says, with regards to the giving of a loan or extending of credit, that patoach tiftach, you have to open up your hand and extend credit to these individuals, despite the fact that there is Shmitat Ksafim and the loans will be forgiven. Einli ela l'aniyei recha. That's only true when it comes to, possibly would have thought, to the aniyim of your city. L'aniyei ira cheret minayin. How do I know that you have to extend yourself or give tzedakah to those that are not in your city? Talmud Omar, patoach tiftach mikol makom. You have to open up your hand irrespective of the location of the individual in need. So there is a hierarchy, which is you have to give aniyei yircha kodem, that the aniyim of your city take precedence over the aniyim of other cities, but your obligation extends beyond the aniyim of your city, that you have an obligation to provide, if you have the means to other aniyim, even outside the location where you live. Naton titain, again, this is in the same parshia in Devarim, that you must give it. Enli ela b'matana meruba. That's only true when you're giving a large gift. Matana mu'etet minayin. How do you know that if even it's a small gift that you have to give it? Tamal omar, naton titain mikol makom. That you have to give it irrespective of the size of the gift. Now, also, despite the fact that it seems that here again the logic is backwards, you would have thought that your obligation is to give a matana mu'etet, then the pasuk should teach you that even a matana meruba is obligatory, because that seems to be the kal v'chomer, which is that if you have to give a big gift, of course you have to give a small gift. So it would have made more sense for the Gemara Savamina to be, oh, you only have to give a small gift. Talmud Omar, you have to give even a big gift. So the way you must understand it has to do with the recipient. Meaning that if you're able to fulfill the needs of the recipient, then maybe there's an obligation on you to give the tzedakah or provide the loan to the individual. But in a case where it doesn't suffice for the individual, maybe there you wouldn't be under an obligation to do it. So that's maybe the logic here as to why matanah meruba is obvious and matanah mu'etet is less obvious. Or you have to say that the obligation to give might only be when you have the sufficient means to give in a large way or in a way that is sufficient. But maybe if you are of lesser means, maybe there's no obligation to lend or to engage with the individual. That's why there's no kal v'chomer, and that's why it's more obvious you have to give more, because that person who's giving more is also endowed with more. The person who's giving less doesn't have the means by which to do it, and therefore maybe they should be exempt completely. That's what the Talmud Lomer is, that don't detain, that there's an obligation to give, irrespective of your means, and irrespective of the size of the gift or the loan that you are extending. Hanik, Tanik, this is the obligation that when you let an Eved Ivri go free, then once he's gone free, you have to give him what's called Hanakah. You have to provide him the means by which to become self-sufficient. So you have to give him gifts when you leave. Ein le'elashnit barech habayit biglalo. Therefore, manikim. So the way the pasuk is phrased, it seems to indicate the reason you're giving him this is because your household was blessed because of this individual. So since he was a party to the blessing, you should also give him a part of that blessing. But that would then indicate that only if your house expanded and there was bracha in the house during the time period that he resided there, then he would be able to take a piece of it, or you'd be obligated to give him a piece of it. If the financial situation in the house actually deteriorated, didn't get better during the time period that was there, you would have thought that maybe he shouldn't get it. Minayin, how do you know that he still does get it? Tamalomar, anik tanik, mi kol makom. There's an obligation to provide this anakah, irrespective of the Eved Ivri's contribution to the bracha of the house, or whether there was a bracha in the house during the time period that he was resident there. According to Rabbi Elazar ben Azayu, who actually reads the pasuk in that manner, that the Gemara here is talking about a havamina, not to read it that way. There is a Tana, Rabbi Elazar, who reads it that way and says, you only have to provide Hanukkah in a situation where the Eved Ivri was resident while things were going well financially. You don't do it, Tanik, Lomali. What does he do with the duplication of the language? Dibra Torah kelashon bnei Adam. It is a literary style of the Torah and nothing that we should be learning from the extraneous language. It's not extraneous. It is the poetic style of the Torah, and therefore you cannot conclude anything from the duplication of the Lashon. The Valya Tosafot over here say something that they say many places in Shas. Here it's a small Tosafot. In other places in Shas, there are large, very large Tosafot to discuss this issue, which is that we find that certain Tanaim seem to say Dibra Torah Lashon Bnei Adam, but they're not consistent in applying it. We don't find that Rabbi Elazar applies it to all the cases where there's duplicate Lashon. He doesn't say, Dibra Torah Lashon Bnei Adam. And similarly, he shows that other Tanaim have that same perspective, which is sometimes they invoke Dibra Torah Lashon Bnei Adam, and sometimes they don't. They're inconsistent in applying it. So what the Balei Tosafot suggests over here is that this is a very parochial understanding that Rabbi Elazar has. When he says that it's Dibra Torah Lashon Bnei Adam, it's in this particular case and cannot be extrapolated with his opinion in other situations. The reason being, as Tosafot says, is that it's midei de muchacha krai. It's something that the psukim are compelling. So over here, Rabbi Elazar is compelled by the pasuk, which tells you specifically that the anakah is tied to the bracha. So normally he would interpret the duplication or the extraneous language as meaning something, but over here he doesn't do that because the psukim seem to indicate otherwise. The psukim seem to limit the obligation and not expand the obligation. Therefore, the duplicate lashon we're not going to use as an expansive view of this din. And that's why he says, Dibrat Torah kilashon b'nei Adam. And that's what Tosafot mentions in many other places, which is that if it's mukhcha milta, then sometimes a person who has a position with regards to a specific din will deviate from that din if the psukim seem to compel them in that direction. And that's what he says, for instance, with kri and ktiv, aim la mikra or aim la misoret. So over there, Tosafot also shows that there's inconsistency in the positions of the Tanaim. And so again, over there, he shows that there are many Tanaim that believe that both are true, and they are convinced or compelled in different locations or different limudim by the nature of the psukim or the lashon of the pasuk. And so therefore, again here, he says this is not a universal, global view of Rabbi Elazar, but rather particular to this case. Haveit avitenu de machzer lo. So you have to provide for him that which he is missing. Ein li elo she'ein lo. That's only the case where he has nothing in his possession. And he doesn't want to accept tzedakah from you. So in a case where he doesn't have the means to support himself, and he doesn't want to accept tzedakah from you, Amar Rachmanan, tein lo derech halva'ah. That's when the Torah says, Haveit tavitenu de machzer lo, provide him with a loan to make up the deficit that he has. Yesh lo ve'einu rotzeh leitpanes. If he has the means by which to support himself, yet he's so miserly that he won't touch his own money, and he wants you to provide help or assistance over here. Ve'einu rotzeh leitpanes. On the other hand, but he doesn't want to take it as a handout, he wants it as a loan. Minayin, how do I know there that you also have to extend the loan? Tamalomar tavitenu mikol makom, that you have to lend to him irrespective of his financial situation, if that's what the necessity of this individual is at this moment. As Rashi points out over here, if the guy has tremendous wealth, but he's so miserly that he doesn't want to use his own money, he'd rather have your money or borrow from you, then at the time that he passes away, you will have a claim against the estate. So basically, the loan is to him with the understanding that you're going to claim it when this guy passes away because of the fact that he shouldn't have been taking tzedakah, or he shouldn't have been taking a loan, he could have used his own money. The fact that he doesn't do it puts him in this predicament, and yes, you are responsible to take care of him, but then you will get reimbursed by the monies of the estate, or what yeshlo, what he does have in his possession. B'Shimon, who says that in a case where he doesn't want to take tzedakah, but he has the means by which to support himself, but he refuses to use his own money. Rabbi Shimon says, we don't deal with this guy. He's on his own. Why should we have to give him money when he has the means by which to take care of himself? Tabitenu lamali. So then for him, why do you have the duplication of the Lashon? Dibrat Torah k'lashon b'nei Adam. Once again, he gives a similar answer that the Torah spoke, or this is a poetic style of the Torah, and therefore you can't conclude anything from it. And again, Tosafot's comments apply here as well, that this is unique to this circumstance, not his general view in the drashot of the Torah. Ayabatel minasela, lo yamar lo, if his desisting from work in order to engage with the Aveda causes him to lose wages of a sela, lo yamar lo, he can't say to the Bal Aveda, ten li sela, give me my compensation. Ela noten lo scharo kupoel, or kupoel batel, which is the girsa that Rashi has, which is that he has to pay him like a poel batel. Tana, noten lo skoro kupoel batel, my kupoel batel. What is this poel batel that you're speaking about over here? Amrabai, kupoel batel shel oto malacha de batel mineh. It is like a poel batel who is desisting from working in the work that he is engaged in. So the way Rashi interprets this is simply that he has a certain wage earning potential that he could engage in right now. He is opting out of that. Now, what we want to know is, how much would someone accept in order to give up the harder work, or to give up the more money to work in a easier situation or a easier function? So poel batel means, how much do I have to compensate you for you to desist from this work and engage in hashavat aveda, which is a much lighter form of work? So people are willing to give up some duress, stress of earning the money and earn less to have a better quality of life. That is where you will get compensated, is for that trade-off, that differential in value of the trade-off. You'll get paid at the lower rate for someone who's willing to take that discount in order to have a better quality of life. If you refuse to do that, that's what we have in the Mishnah, which is upcoming in the Gemara, is the Tanai Beit Din, that you have to then stipulate to Beit Din in order to allow you to do that. So that's what Rashi claims is the Kuboel Batel. Whereas Tosafot, later on, in Daf Samech Chenom and Aleph says, Kach Nira Lefereish Kuboel Batel, Hainu, Kiyoshev Ubatel Legamre. But the guy is completely unemployed. And how much would this person take in order to leave their unemployment and do some work? I mean, how much do you have to pay them to actually get them to be engaged or basically underemployed? Which is that they have a skill set that they could use, but they're currently unemployed. Now, if you give them work, how much are they willing to take in order to come out of unemployment but not be engaged in the work that they're normally engaged in? So that's what's Kapoel Badel. If you are currently unemployed, how much of an underemployment would you accept in order to make some money over here? What wage would make you engage in melacha that is not your primary profession but does gain you wages and as you leave the unemployment rolls? So that would be the question of Kapoel Badel based on the Tosafot and Samech Chenom and Aleph. That's what the Rabbeinu Chananel says over here. Ela b'sharim scharok 8 she'en lo ma yitfor. It's a case here where he has nothing to weave or stitch right now, so he has no work. El Yosheva Batel is sitting home, unengaged, unemployed. Im yivo adam yomer lo hanach Yosheva Batel tikach bit firat beged chatzi sela o tisha'er batel ayom. Take this beged and do it for a half a sela, or you're going to stay unemployed. Ube'echa melacha mitzuya kagon karov l'regel. In another instance where he was very busy, he would not have accepted the work in that instance because he'd be paid much more. But here, where he's unemployed, he'd be willing to accept less pay, or he would do it at a lower price because he has nothing doing. That's the way the Rabbeinu Chananel and the Balei Tosafot explain it, is that person's currently unemployed. How much is it taken to come out of unemployed and be, in its essence, underemployed or underpaid what he would normally get for this type of work? So that's the question at hand, and that's what you would get for Shavat Avedah versus Rashi, who says the person is currently employed. How much of a discount would he take from his current wages in order to do less work or to do something of a lighter nature? Both Tosfot and the Ramban ask a more fundamental question over here, which is, generally we have a principle that we learned in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, that Mavriach Harim Nichsei Chaveiro, someone who protects his friend's possessions from a lion, cannot demand compensation from the individual. So why don't we say the same thing over here, that the return of the Avedah is just a prevention of loss? If that's the case, maybe the person is not entitled to any compensation or any payment. So both the Balei Tosfot and the Ramban differentiate between the cases and say, first of all, that the case of Mavriach Harim Nichsei Chaveiro is only a case where you are protecting the person from fear of something happening, versus over here, or a case where what is called bari chazeka, there is clear and present danger. In that case, you can demand compensation. When it's just a worry or it's a safek, there you can't ask for compensation. But where there is clear and present danger, or the loss is in front of us, then you can demand compensation. And so our case of the Aveda would be under the category of clear and present danger, or loss that can be anticipated because of the fact that the object is now lost, and therefore you have a right to claim for compensation. And that's what the Tosafot says over here. That he's afraid it's going to come. Therefore he is patur. About matzil mi pi ari. Shataf nar chamaro v'chamar aveda debari chazeka b'zevitzil notel scharo. In addition, the case of Mavriach Harim in Echasav is something that you engage in voluntarily. Over here, the Torah compels you to do a Shabbat Aveda. If that's the case, maybe that also creates a distinction that would allow you to make a claim for compensation, because here you don't have a choice. You must engage in the Aveda. Whereas Mavriach Harim in Echasav is completely up to you. It's a reshut, it's voluntary, and therefore you don't have a right to make a claim for compensation. And then Tosafot deals with other cases that don't seem to conform to this distinction that he is drawing, and he tries to bring answers or deal with those situations individually. Now Gemara says, Im yesham beitin matneh bifnehem. Isur v'rav safra avid iska b'hadei adodi. Issa and Rav Safra entered into a partnership, a business partnership. Azo Rav Safra palaglei below date the isur. So Rav Safra went ahead and either unwound the partnership or splitted profits of the partnership without the knowledge of his partner, ba'ape beitrei, in front of two edim. So he has two edim there who are watching this allocation. And he goes ahead and splits it, but without the knowledge or presence of Isur. Ata the kamei. Now, who he came in front of is very difficult here. We have an argumara, the Rabba bar Rav Huna, is who he came to present the case in front of. You look in the Rabbeinu Chananel, it says Rova, that they came in front of Rova. It's interesting here, because the Rabbeinu Chananel on the end of yesterday's daf, where was the statement about the Chol HaBeidah Tachikra is including Karka, argumara as a gears of Rova, the Rabbeinu Chananel has a girsa of Rabba. You can see in the Mesorah Tashas, he brings Rosh Ita Rabbi Ava. And then he says that the Tosfot and Baba Batra and Rabbi Kiva Eger also brings from the Tosfot in Baba Batra that it was Rav Nachman. So over here you have a choice of who the case was brought before. Who did Isur bring the case to? Was it Rabba Bar Rav Huna, Rava, Rav Nachman, or Rabbi Abba? Amarle zil aite tlato de palgat kamayu. So he says to Rav Safra, go ahead and bring me the three people in front of whom you did this division. As Rashi notes over here, the division is not just splitting money, where it's like counting how many coins here, how many coins there. It's property that needs to be assessed, and then the value of that property or that merchandise has to be split between them. So you need some sort of expert assessment in order to divide it up. Inami, or treimi go tlata. Bring me two out of the three dayanim that will testify to the fact that it was done in front of three. Vinami, trei sade, depagat bape be tlato. Or just bring me two independent edim that you split this in front of a beitin. Amalei min alacha. So if Safra challenges him and says, where do you have a source for the fact that you need to have a beitin in order to divide up the property? I'm related to Tanan, because we have a Mishnah. Im yesh sham beitin matne bifnehem. If there's a beitin there, then he can make it a condition of the return of the Avodah before them. Ain sham beitin mifimi itneh. He doesn't have a beitin there in front of whom he can make that condition. Shelo kodem. Then his goes first. What he is suggesting is that our Mishnah indicates that in monetary matters or monetary decisions, you need a beitin involved in order to assess the value of your work vis-a-vis the value of the Aveda that you are returning. Amalei mi domi. How can you compare the cases? Hatam de mafik mamona mahai umotiv lahai bina beitin. Over here in our case of the Mishnah, you're taking money from one party and giving it to another party. You're giving the money of the Baal Aveda to the Motzei, to the finder of the Aveda who engaged in a Shavat Aveda. So you're transferring ownership of money from one party to the next. Aval hocha, in this case, didei shakle. He's taking what belongs to him. Giloi milta ba'amahu. It's not a transfer of ownership, but simply an indication of what the values are. Betrei sagile. There, two witnesses is sufficient. You don't need expert assessments. You're not moving value from one part to the other. You're simply dividing up an existing asset. Over there, you just need to identify or clarify the pricing of the asset, and that two people are sufficient for. Teida, and I'll prove that to you, to the non, because we have a Mishnah in Ketubot, that says, Almana mocheret shelo bifnei beitin, that a widow has permission to sell property of the estate in order to provide her mizunot, without beitin being present. So you see that in cases where you're not transferring ownership, there you don't require a beitin. If it's simply just monetizing objects that are there, then you can do it in front of two witnesses or without a beitin. Tosfot asks you a question, which is, how do you extrapolate from Almanah? It's clear that Almanah gets a special dispensation, what the Gemara calls in other places, Mishum China, which is that in order that she gets married in the front end, we give her rights in the back end so that the women will be more willing to get married, because they don't have risks in the back end, that they're going to have to go before Beit Din, they're not going to be able to sell them as an oath, they're not going to be protected in the back end. So there's a protection in particular for women in order to encourage them to get married, or Shalotit Bazeh Beit Din, in order that the woman doesn't have to go out to Beit Din and be embarrassed in a public setting to have to deal with this.
She could stay at home and deal with it. So maybe this is unique to an almana. Who says you can extrapolate from almana? So Tosfot says, "Tisvele kevin da almana mocheret afagav de'ena shela shelo bebeitim mishum china." Since the almana has permission to sell that which isn't hers without the auspices of beitim because of china, hakana mishutaf he told it shelo bebeitim afka delechatam dechina. A shutaf can take what belongs to him. So since the almana is working with other people's property, and she has china, therefore she doesn't need a beitim. So in our case, where it's a lower level, which is that you're taking what belongs to you, not someone else's property, then even though you don't have china, maybe there too you wouldn't need a beit din. So since each one of them has this aspect, she has the aspect of china, he has the aspect of the fact that he's taking his own property, not someone else's property, each of those will offset each other, and therefore the din should be the same. You should be able to do it without a beit din. So Amar Le Abaye, V'lav Mi Itmar Allah, don't we have a qualification of that Mishnah? Amar Rav Yosef Ben Nume, Amar Rav Nachman, Almana in Etzricha Beit Din Shel Mumchin. She doesn't require a Beit Din of experts. Aval Tzricha Beit Din Shel Jotot, she does require a Beit Din of lay people. So the Gemara says that that maybe is not a proof to the fact that you don't require a Beit Din, because over there, when we say she doesn't require a Beit Din, it means she doesn't require an expert Beit Din. But she still requires a Beit Din. And if that's the case, so to in our situation, you should require a beit din in order to do the splitting of the partnership, and it shouldn't suffice to have two edim. So then Tosfot over here differentiates in terms of when a beit din of edyodot versus a beit din of mumchim is needed, and he says, Ishlamar, kevin shalokech latzma, when a person is self-dealing, they will need a beit din of mumchim. When a person is dealing with an independent buyer, then they can do it with the Beit Din of Hedjotot. Meaning that if a person is taking something from the other party for themselves, and therefore there's no objective sale to a third party, then you would require Beit Din of Mumchin there to be sure that the value is correct. But in a scenario situation where you're selling to other people, then there's already a verification of value because someone else is involved in the transaction. Therefore, a Beit Din of Hedjotot will suffice in that case. Tosfot then asks, wait a minute, with an almana, which we just saw here, that an almana is allowed to sell to other parties without a Beit Din at all. And if she has a Beit Din, she can keep it for herself, which indicates otherwise, because here we just saw that the Beit Din of an almana is a Hedjotot. So that means that for an almana, she can, with a Beit Din of Hedjotot, keep it for herself. And without any Beit Din at all, she could sell it through a third party, which seems to be different than what Tosfot just concluded over here about these requirements. So Tosfot says over here, V'yesh lamar, that comes down to the unique standing of an almana, the mocheret shelo be-Beit Din mishum china, that the reason that an almana gets this dispensation or has a different din than anyone else is because of this issue of china. We want to encourage women to get married and not worry about what's going to happen in the back end. So therefore, we give her greater latitude in the back end. Or again, because lotit bazeh be-Beit Din, that she should not be embarrassed or necessitated to leave the house and go to Beit Din to deal with these issues on a regular basis. And therefore, an almana gets better situation, which is that if she's dealing with third parties, she needs no Beit Din at all. And if she's dealing with herself, she needs a Beit Din ve-Yotot. But if you have like a gabbai tzedaka, in that situation, if he's self-dealing, we'll need a Beit Din Shel Mumchin, and if he's selling to third parties, then he'll need at least a Beit Din Shel Hedjotot. Because any time that you are involved in a situation where there might be conflicts of interest, and there are different levels of conflicts of interest. Here you're selling something on behalf of Staka. There's a lower issue of conflict of interest, but there's still issues. Therefore you need a Beit Din Shel Hedjotot, at least to supervise. In a case where you're selling it to yourself, where there's a high likelihood of self-dealing and benefiting yourself, there you need a Beit Din of Mumchim to ensure that the self-dealing does not do it at the expense of the tzedakah or the institution from whom you are working. With that, we're going to stop here before the Mishnah on Daf Lamed Bet, Amud Aleph.